3, 2, 1. Download the future. From earlier in these consoles' lifecycle. This is the edition for April, and some of you will know that this month's game of the month was Prey. I'm Zantiriad, better known as Zan, and this month I'm joined by Strident. Welcome, Strident.
Hi, nice to be on.
And of course, it wouldn't be Cranky Gamers without the podcaster extraordinaire Ditz.
Hi, everybody.
As this is only your second show, I'll just run through the basic premise of what Replay is. So basically, if you've got old 360, PS3 or Wii games that are sitting on the shelf, the idea is that with Replay you can revisit them, play along with everyone else, and see, you know, how well they've aged. Are there some of these games can be picked up really cheap, so they're often a good way to really make the most of your collection you've got, or make the most of the bargains that are currently out there. It's a monthly podcast, and at the end of this show, we'll be nominating the games for you to choose for next month, along with Call of Duty 2, which was actually carried over from last month's vote. Once the game's chosen, you can actually join in by visiting the forum, where you'll find that there'll be dedicated Replay game parties if the game has multiplayer. You can submit a review as a written form or as an audio. And, of course, you can actually be a guest on the podcast, just like Strident is this month. Okay, so moving swiftly on. So this month, as I said, the game was Prey, which was an early launch title on the Xbox 360. And Strident, would you first of all like to describe the game's box art so that we can spell the shelves?
It's an absolute classic, this one. It looks like somebody's done it on a photocopier, actually, because it's this sort of this horrible washed-out grey colour with the words Prey in black. With that slightly, you know, the sort of the thing you get around the outline when you do a glowy, like, letters. So somebody's gone into Photoshop, put Prey and put glowy letters on. It's got some sort of strange bird shape flying up, and the words "We Are Next" at the top. So it doesn't really give much of a clue what's the game about. But like I say, I guess you can see the title. That's one good thing going for the box art.
It's fairly abstract, isn't it? I don't think it really leaps out at you when you look at it on the shelf there. It doesn't catch your eye so much.
It doesn't really scream first person shooter, does it? It doesn't have the man there with the gun it doesn't really explain anything of the game.
Normally you have sort of some guy with a chick and a big gun, don't you, or something like that.
I wonder if that was a conscious decision not to put the main character on the box. Whether they thought that might affect sales or not, who knows?
Well, this comes from the same studio as Duke Nukem, doesn't it? So, and the Duke was all over the cover of his box, so I guess, you know, perhaps they're trying to preserve that. Right then, Ditz, do you want to explain what the game is and for anyone who hasn't played along?
Well, it's a first-person shooter. It's quite an early one for the Xbox 360. And you play as a Cherokee Indian who really wants to leave the reservation, go off with his girlfriend, and she doesn't really want to leave. But in the midst of you trying to convince her to leave, the aliens come down and abduct everyone. I mean, it's just that age-old story, I guess. And it's basically the whole game is you then trying to get your girl back and defeat the aliens and get back home.
No. It's like boy meets girl, aliens abduct girl, boy tries to get girl back using great big gun.
There you go.
It's a classic, isn't it?
Actually, I just remembered something I should have said at the beginning of the show. If you don't like spoilers, don't listen any further.
That's a good point, actually.
This is not a spoiler-free show, so there's going to be lots of spoilers, like Grandad, which we'll come to. What sort of modes does it have? Is it single player, multiplayer, bit of both?
It's single player and multiplayer as well. I mean, the majority of it is, most of the achievements and the bulk of the game is the single player. But, I mean, we did try a bit of multiplayer, didn't we?
We did indeed, yeah. I think we'll come to that a little bit later. Mm-hmm. Now, Striden, I know you dug up quite an interesting article before we recorded the show from GamePro. I don't know whether you want to just run through some of the points from that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to have a go at GamePro or anything. It's just I just stumbled across it while I was looking at reviews to see what people thought about the game at the time. And it's just interesting to see how difficult it is to predict the future and how difficult it is to evaluate like the long-term impact of games like this. The article was entitled, "The Six Ways Prey Will Change Gaming." And I should point out it was on the PC side of things because Prey was, of course, a PC and an Xbox 360 title. So what I'll do is I'll just run through the six ways that they thought Prey would change gaming. It's always a bit worrying when they say the six ways. It's like, well, they couldn't come up with 10 or they had one more than five or a bit indecisive, couldn't make what the exact five were. But I'll go through them anyway. The first point was death is no longer an end. They said that Prey does away with save crawling or checkpoints and turns death into a kind of amusing minigame. Yeah. Which is, I mean, it's not something I don't think that we've seen recreated until, well, very recently. You could argue that Prince of Persia, the latest game, has a similar sort of way of dealing with death as Prey does.
Mm-hmm. Just trying to think, like Fable 2 as well, didn't really have quite an easy death mechanic, didn't it?
That's true.
It's kind of a trend in this generation. They're trying to make these games more accessible. They're sort of introducing that as, you know, I mean, some of the games, the checkpointing is very, you know, sympathetic, isn't it? It's very easy.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the reasons I liked it, which I'll probably mention later, is that, you know, you felt like every second you put into the game, you actually progressed. You weren't always backtracking to save points. And when you're someone like me who's not very good at these games and is trying to get through this thing for this podcast, you know, it's quite good that you only have to spend a limited amount of time on the game, I think.
Okay. You had some more, didn't you? Sorry, that was just one.
Yeah, that was just one. Prey, six ways Prey will change. It's not just that. A skewed perspective, they reckon, the perspective warping level design. It was more than just vertical inducing. It was more than just a vertigo inducing gimmick, and that it's referring to the use of portals in the game, which were static sort of portals that you would go through and suddenly find yourself either in a completely different area or maybe on the ceiling of the area that you were currently in. There were gravity rooms where if you shot a certain symbol on the wall, the whole room would suddenly flip over and you'd find yourself falling onto what was once the ceiling and was now the floor. And there's a sort of a wall-walking system in place in this alien spaceship where you can walk up these gravity things on the wall. Why it's in the alien spaceship, I'm not quite sure. So they reckon, obviously, that was instantly going to change all future games, and all future games would have this sort of wacky, amazing level design.
Don't think we've seen that, have we? sort of appear in a lot of other games.
I don't think so at all. But the next point was they've labelled story glory. It says it was a surprisingly smart, well-crafted story that will shatter your preconceived notions and subvert your assumptions. It's interesting looking back at the reviews, actually, that people either thought it was a really, really clever story or they thought it was a really, really stupid story. it's quite common these days that happens in reviews as well.
Mm-hmm. I'd have to go with the latter on that one, but yeah.
Especially when you get to the end, I think. Mm-hmm. Next point, character is as character does. And they were citing the fact that Tommy's not the mute, cold-hearted killer, that's their words, you see in other games. Well, he's certainly not mute, is he? I think Ditch would say when you get towards the end of a game, he's got quite a bit of a potty mouth on him.
Yeah, he goes a little bit crazy, doesn't he? But I did
quite
like him as a main character as well.
I mean, I've only played just under halfway through, but all the bits I saw, it was more like you know, sort of the Arnold Schwarzenegger school of acting, you know, Adrian, he was just like, and I'm sorry, that was bloody Stallone, wasn't it? But anyway, it was just, it just seemed to be just shouting out every time he saw his missus or granddad going around the conveyor belts. It wasn't a great deal of dialogue. Is there more at the end then?
No, he kind of keeps it to one-liners. I think they've gone for the whole Duke Nukem school of thought again.
Yeah, it's not Shakespeare, that's for sure. And I think perhaps they were comparing him to his contemporaries, you know, like Gordon Freeman, who doesn't say anything and doesn't seem to react to what goes on around him. They were at least saying he was reacting to some of the horrors and stuff he saw on the alien spaceship. Next one down, it says, "The game is not your enemy. Prey is one of the least frustrating, most intuitive shooters yet."
Yeah.
Well, the evidence it was using was the fact that the ammo was came pretty regularly, and they were seeming to suggest that if you were running out, that the game would somehow give you some more. And they were also talking about Talon, the spirit guide, who sort of flies around and shows you where to go next and which button to go and press. So that's what they were saying, really.
Yeah, I have a slightly different take on Talon, because I think Talon was added because it was too difficult. It's the sort of thing that certainly playing the sort of half I did, the impression I got was that Talon wasn't something that the game was designed around. It felt like something that was added later to make it easier for you to navigate, because some of the puzzles are so four-dimensional, aren't they, that, you know, if you didn't have those clues, you would spend ages trying to work out what you're supposed to do.
Yeah, he seemed to perch on the...
you go ahead, sorry.
So, yeah, Talon did perch on maybe like a console you had to press the button or something. Yeah. But that was helpful. But then a bit, like, another bit to the game, he'd just perch somewhere and wouldn't actually, you know, there'd be nothing yet there for you to do. So he could actually be quite off-putting sometimes.
I mean, the idea of a spirit guide sort of fits in with a whole Native American theme that sort of got put on top of it, I think, of the game. I found him quite useful when he was going off attacking enemies, because he was squawking and I could actually locate, especially those horrible flying ones that you get a lot towards the end of the game. The next point, more meat, less fat. Also, this is for 6 point, actually. They said it was lean and mean. The single-player campaign comes in just under 10 hours. It's surprisingly satisfying with very little repetition. And it's a quality of quantity, the antidote to soaring development costs, they reckon.
Okay. The game took about 6 years to make, didn't it?
I think it's been in development in various forms since 1995, and it got sort of shelved until the engine could cope with Portal. It's almost as bad as Duke Nukem Forever.
So for GamePro to say it was a good example of lean, cheap production values, and it had taken them over 10 years to make. Oh, well. Okay, that's the sixth one, isn't it?
That is the sixth one. I mean, okay. Long-term impact Prey has, hasn't it?
Yeah. So we've got a couple of reviews that were posted on the forum. I've got one here from Crazy Chris. He of Flight Control fame. He's got some enormous score I saw today on Twitter. Give up on that game, I think. So he says, just a few thoughts, moments that stood out. So he loved the Don't Fear the Reaper coming on before the abduction, which is right at the very beginning of the game, and I have to agree with that. I love that bit. That's probably the best opening of a first-person shooter I've played in a long time. Probably only Bioshock really has a dramatic opening like that. It's really cool.
Yeah, I think it's ranked third on a Game Informer's list of the top 10 video game openings ever. I can't recall what were the two above it, but
it's really good, isn't it? It really sucks you in. I was really impressed by that. Next one, I expected a slightly more reactive environment, i.e. knocking around small objects with a wrench, a small and insignificant thing to be missing, but it just showed that this was a release game. There was those kind of sticky ball things you had to knock around, wasn't there? But there wasn't a great deal of material.
There was quite a bit of, you said you had them little ball things which could blow up and open up certain doors, but they were using a bit of a custom Doom 3 engine, weren't they, which had all these sort of things that would fall over, and I think they they were there really to add atmosphere, so something would clang when it gets shot over and make it a bit more realistic and scary. But I don't think it really worked that well in the Prey actual environment and game.
No, I don't think you always need it either. Often when I fire up a game and I see the Havoc logo come up, I think, oh God, here we go. There's going to be loads of these things where I've got to pick something out with a gravity gun and throw it around for 10 minutes. So it's not always... I don't think you really always have to have that, but I suppose I can kind of see his point. Okay, the next one. Hearing the man on the radio worrying about his daughter, then slightly later calling through a vent to hear a child screaming before his parents... in front of his parents before they get chunked. Kind of made me want to forge on and help do my bit. Which is fair enough. There are some pretty gruesome scenes. There's actually... I saw one scene. I think I was right in seeing this. It was children actually killing each other, which I thought was a bit strong. I don't know if you guys saw that one.
Yeah, it's... Sorry, it's...
Go on,
it just... No, that just seemed to be just sort of thrown in there. There was all sorts of stuff with, like, spirit children and that just sort of seemed to be tacked in. They didn't seem to fit in with the main story. I just ended up fighting a bunch of them at one point and was never quite sure why they were actually in there, apart from they sort of like they felt, oh, well, children are scary. Let's throw in some spirit children to attack you. Very strange.
Yeah, I think I don't know if the developers just... that they got told, right, you can't carry on with this idea, you can have it in there, it's a little bit too risky, you know, we need to cut it down. But it was quite creepy at the start when you see, I think there's two kids in a cell and one of the kids killed the other one basically, and then it turned into a spirit and came and attacking you. And then I think a bit later on there's like an old school bus, like the American yellow bus, and then all the kids come out as spirit and start trying to kill you. But that's it. It just sort of leaves it there. There's no real explanation as to why they're there, what's going on. It's weird. It looks like a missed opportunity or something where they were told, actually, guys, you can't do this.
Yeah, it's quite tough, some of the stuff to watch, I thought, at the beginning. Well, certainly those parts, anyway. Crazy Chris goes on to say he thought they laid on the Cherokee story heritage pretty thickly, especially near the end. But then again, that was the main hook of the game. I don't know what you guys think of that, but it seemed fairly appropriate. Other than, again, at points I felt it was kind of tacked on bits I played.
I think that was one of the reasons. I think you mentioned it on the last podcast, and I thought, oh, Prey sounds quite interesting. If you know the character was somebody different, other than a big muscle bound white male blowing up stuff, and I quite like all the sort of mythology stuff for Native American and world mythology, so I thought, oh, that'd be quite interesting. It'd be interesting to see what they did with it.
Yeah, I must admit that was the big hook for me, was the Native American stuff in it. But, I quite like the bit where you're introduced to the spirit world, and you first get the bow and stuff. I thought that was really, really well done. Well, he goes on to say, didn't think too much of the puzzles for the most part. I couldn't progress. When I couldn't progress, I just switched to spirit mode and hit the nearest switch. Rarely use spirit mode for anything else. Though, to be fair, the cube puzzle completely stumped me. The spirit mode, I couldn't really work out what I was supposed to do with it to start with. And then I sort of realised that, okay, this is how I get through sort of barriers and stuff that I can't actually walk through.
Yeah, I really actually like the puzzles. I think a lot of FPSs right now don't have any puzzles at all. And, you know, you had to use the spirit quite a lot. And basically, once you figured out, oh, I need to go into spirit mode, press this button, and it'll make a bridge go across or something, then they kind of reused that over and over. But they would throw in different ideas, like, you know, you'd maybe have to try and just walk back to your body whilst pressing the button and... I really like the puzzles. I thought it was quite a nice addition. It would have made the game a lot worse, I think, without it.
Okay, Chris's final point. He talks about the achievements. He said the achievements are balanced, and you get achievements for playing through in different styles, killing enemies, and you also get achievements per level, and the achievements increment as you go up through levels, which he likes, and most people like achievements like that. And then finally, he just finished off by saying that he timed himself. I think you made this point earlier, Strident, from the GamePro article. It took him 6.5 hours. He found that to be quite good. It was just the right length for him. Anyone else got any comments on that?
Well, I mean, it depends how much you pay for it, doesn't it? And if there is multiplayer, and if a multiplayer is any good. But, I mean, 6.5 hours, I think it would have struggled to sustain itself beyond that. So I can see why it was that short. Because, like Did says, the puzzles were just reused all the way through. The enemies and environments were pretty samey all the way through. And if we'd been going on 10-plus hours, I think it would have started to get really, really boring towards the end.
Yes, because the combat was very easy as well. I think there was a variety of enemies. I think more towards the end you got to see quite a different range of enemies, but they were all quite easy to kill. And I think, as you say, without the puzzles, that 10 hours or 6 hours would have probably been 4, if not a lot less.
Game length is often quite a sort of interesting topic, really, because sometimes you get a 10-12 hour game and you feel like the game's been artificially stretched. You know, you have to do a lot of backtracking, or you have to do a lot of fetch quests and things like that, and it becomes irritating, doesn't it? And you sometimes think to yourself, look, I could do without these repetitive bits. I just want to make my way through the story. Then you get other games where you sort of blast through it in 5 or 6 hours and you think, well, is that it? Is there no more to it? So it's a very difficult balancing act, I think, for a game developer to actually get it just right.
It's good how they did it as well. There was some chapters were quite long, and other ones could just take you 10 minutes, and it was just, I don't know, just different chunks. I guess if you want just a quick blast, do the level, turn it off, come back the next day, then it was okay for that, because some of the chapters were quite short.
Yeah. Okay, Dix, do you want to give us the next posted review?
Okie doke. Well, this one's in from Leg of Time. He was on the podcast, wasn't he, last month?
Yep.
Yeah, and he says that he's been playing the single player for about a month now, and he's been enjoying it for the most part. He's only reached level 8, and so he's only about a third of the way through it, but he is still enjoying it. He likes the whole perspective change, the walking up walls, but does seem a bit tacked on in places. He thinks the graphics are okay, but it's nothing special. But it was a launch title, so you can kind of forgive them for that. He didn't really use spirit mode much, so he can't really comment on it. I don't know how he's going to progress without using that. It gets quite heavy later.
Yeah, I think it's the same as me, because I've not got much further than Leg, and up until that point, I think you only really use it to open your door and to solve some very basic puzzles.
He's also saying that multiplayer should be avoided at all costs. Yeah, we did have a little go, didn't we?
We did, yeah.
And he says the maps are well laid out and the portal jumping work well, but the lag is terrible. And yeah, I think we had an absolutely terrible experience trying this, didn't we?
We did, yeah. Yeah, it was pretty awful. In fact, there was more problems with it than just the lag, I thought. But maybe we'll come to that in a bit later.
Mm. Overall, though, he thinks that the game is good. The single-player story seems quite good for the part he played, but it's let down a bit by the multiplayer, and he's given it a little score at the end of 6 out of 10, which is quite reasonable, really.
Yeah, it's not too bad, is it? I mean, also only played halfway through, so that's respectable, I suppose. Okay, so those are the views from obviously the forum and from GamePro, although I think they've damaged their credibility with some of their comments. I'm just going to put these questions out to the panel. So let's start with yourself, Strident. So what did you find the most enjoyable part of playing the game?
Oh, I think it's what I mentioned earlier was I just like the fact that I could put it on for an hour or so in the evening and actually feel like I'd made real progress. I wasn't dying constantly. I didn't feel that, like, I was constantly going back to the same checkpoint. I always felt that I'd just got that bit further into the game each night, and it just wasn't wasted time. The fact that it was short levels, they chucked nice achievements at the end of each one, it sort of kept me motivated through something that I probably wouldn't normally have played to completion without that, I think.
Okay. Ditz, same question to you. What do you find most enjoyable?
I like the set pieces. I think, as I said a bit earlier, the introduction to the game was one of the best I've ever seen, and the adult nature of it all as well. I really liked some of the cutscenes, some of the ideas behind it. But I think some elements just weren't implemented very well, but others were, you know, head and shoulders above everything and really stand out and make it better. I think someone said about the Don't Fear the Reaper. I thought that was an excellent moment. You sort of walk around and you just realise what's happening, and something like that just builds atmosphere, and it had a nice sense of atmosphere, and you know, you knew that something wrong was going on.
Okay. I suppose for me personally, the thing I really loved the opening. I thought that was amazing. But also at the beginning in the bar, you can actually change the music on the jukebox to different songs. And then as you sort of progress through some of the levels on the ship, there's various other things you can sort of stop and listen to. You know, there's like radio chatter from Earth's surface. You know, there's like radio phone-ins for these guys from Texas phoning in saying their cows are being abducted and things like that. I really like the fact they thought about putting a level of detail in that they probably didn't have to. It reminded me a bit of games like The Darkness, you know, where you had... You know, all these things, I think, help if you can add these kind of layers to it.
Yeah, so I mean, you're saying that the jukebox, there was also like arcade machines. You could sit and play blackjack and all sorts. Yeah. And they were really nice touches, actually. And I think they were using, it was the Doom 3 engine, I believe, and that there were bits in Doom which were the same. We had like Super Turkey Puncher, all this. You could sit and just play that. And yeah, I stopped playing the game for about 10 minutes, just sat there and played blackjack for a little while, which was quite nice.
I made that mistake as well. I sat at the beginning of a game because I sort of knew there was some achievements connected to the machine, and I played all the machines to get the achievements. And then later on, since finishing the game, I found out that the machines further in where, that have been adopted, further in the when you encounter them again in the ship, they're actually rigged, so you win a lot easier. So I didn't have to spend like the half an hour, 45 minutes I spent at the beginning trying to get the, you know, $250 win in it. I could have just played them as I went along.
Well, so
it serves me right for looking at the achievement first, doesn't it?
Yeah, I need to do that as well. I didn't realise you could get an achievement for them. I played the blackjack just for the fun of it. I didn't realise you could achieve.
Yeah, I think there's a, well, there's either 30 or 60 points, like either 10 or 20 for each one. I mean, that'll really boost your score up to... Beyond 60,000, then, I know, but...
Yeah, it's funny, because, well, that's a whole other discussion, but some games I look at the achievement list before I start, other games I just think, oh, I can't be bothered, I'm just going to play through it, and what I get, I get. So I think that was the kind of attitude I took, so I didn't really look at them. Oh, well. I'll have to go back to and try and get those, I think. Okay, so next question is, what did you find most annoying or most broken about the game? Let's start with Ditz this time.
Most annoying, I'd probably say, or actually most annoying and most genius as well, would be the level design. Whoever was the actual designer, they must have had him on something, because some of these levels are so out there. I mean, nothing really follows like a logical going through the corridor, go right here, go there, because one minute you're on the ceiling, next minute you're in a portal, next minute you're... I don't know, upside down on the ceiling trying to shoot things, which it's just madness, absolute madness. But they were really cool, but other bits were just like, what am I meant to do? And it just didn't really help you along in that way, which was, you know, it kind of broke the game a little bit for me, because I'd be wandering around for maybe 20 minutes going, I don't get it. What am I supposed to do now? So, and another thing which I didn't quite like as well, we said about Talon earlier. And your actual spirit powers. I would have liked to have seen a lot more spirit powers. I think we just got the bow and arrow, and that was about it. I think some more things to use would have made it a bit more enjoyable, a bit more fun to use.
Okay, Strident, same question to you.
Yeah, I felt that the game didn't really kick things up a notch towards the end. It was just quite flat all the way through. I just didn't feel like I was being pushed or taxed very much. You know, the enemies didn't seem to get much harder, really, and the puzzles didn't seem to get much harder, and I didn't seem to be dying much more than I did at the start, which either I'm an amazing player and I managed to avoid realizing that all these years, but or it was just very flat in terms of the difficulty level.
Okay, I suppose from my point of view, the thing I'd annoyed me the most, really, is the thing you were talking about, Ditz, was the kind of disorientation of it. I thought sometimes the kind of four-dimensional puzzles worked really well, you know, where you'd have to keep switching from ceiling to floor to get over a particular area, or you had to use a you know, two portals to kind of get around an obstacle. And then other times it just didn't seem to make any sense at all, and I just had this permanent feeling of nausea, sort of flipping and dropping and whizzing around, you know, and you sort of walk around a corner and suddenly drop through the floor, and then you'd be upside down, and then you'd walk around the corner again and you'd flip over and you think, what's going on? I've lost complete track of what I was supposed to be doing and where am I and what my... I just found it a bit too confusing at times, and the thing that killed it for me actually was playing the multiplayer, which does include the portals and the same sort of mechanics, and I found that really disorientating. Now, it was made worse by the fact it was so laggy. So I think the analogy I used on the forum was it was like spending an hour in a washing machine trying to count marbles, and that's what it really felt like.
Oh, it was really like a case of we'd all run round for about, you know, 2 minutes trying to find each other, and then when we found each other, you sort of stand at each other and try and vaguely aim the gun in the direction of the other player as they jump about with lag. And, you know, it's whoever fell down first won, I think. Very disappointing.
I think it tried to be too clever, didn't it? Putting the whole... You had vehicles in there, the portals, the walking things. It's just too much to take when you're, you know, concentrating on trying to stay alive and trying to find the people.
Yeah, it just seemed to make a lot of it feel a bit random to me, or a bit, I don't know. Maybe that's why it took so long to develop, you know. Maybe that's why they had to add talent to the game. It just to me, felt like at certain points, the level design and the game design was broken, and it had too many ideas going on at once. That was the thing for me. Okay, so the big question now. So, Strident, would you recommend anyone to pick up this game if they haven't done so already?
Yeah, because, I mean, you can get it pre-owned for a fiver. I think I bought it new from Amazon for just under £10. And for a short, focused single-player experience, that's pretty good value. And a decent amount of achievement points. I think I picked up over 700, and that doesn't include really any of the multiplayer ones. So that's good value.
Okay, same question to you, Dits.
I think I'll echo what Strident says there. I mean, it is very cheap. I picked it up for £5 secondhand. The achievements are nice and easy to get, and it's a different game. It's not a typical Halo 3 Call of Duty. It's a different first-person shooter. If you're, you know, if you're a little bit tired of just blasting through everything, and I think it's different enough to keep people interested for however long it lasts. So.
Okay, and I'll probably echo that as well. I think as long as you avoid the multiplayer, I think it's actually it's a pretty enjoyable back to basics, apart from the crazy 4D level stuff, first person shooter, because it's kind of in the mold of, like you said, Doom and Duke Nukem, but with these crazy sort of four dimensional puzzles thrown into the mix. So I said the only thing that ruined it for me, that stopped me playing it really, was that session we had on multiplayer. I just couldn't face it after that. But I probably will go back and finish it, because probably only another 3 hours or so for me to go. Okay, so there we go. So that's a basic thumbs up, I would say. Dits, you got something else to add?
I was just thinking just about another thing, what I did enjoy about it, and it was back to the puzzles. I don't know, did anyone look at the consoles where it was written in the alien language, and then if you stood there for a little bit longer, it'd switch to English?
Oh, no, I didn't. I did try and read them, but I didn't realise the language changed.
Yeah, it'd say things like... You're near the mother and all this, but sometimes there'd be like a keypad where you'd have to press the buttons to get in, basically, and do the right code, and it'd be hidden somewhere in the alien language, and you'd have to wait for it and then go to the console and wait for that to switch back to sort of normal numbers, just not alien language, and go through. And that was a nice little addition, again, just different, basically.
Well, there were lots of nice little touches, like Zan was saying before, to make it, you know, appear like a... Especially to make it appear like an alien spaceship. I think they were trying to do a Borg, you know, best of both worlds, going into the Borg spaceship type thing with lots of little drones wandering around doing jobs and, you know, not threatening you, to try and give it that bit of atmosphere. And the alien language and all the readouts and stuff were just nice little touches that just gave it that little bit of extra sparkle. The only thing that spoilt it for me was I just didn't feel like any of the stuff that was in it, like the gravity changing rooms and the wall walking tracks, they just didn't seem to serve any point. And I'm thinking, well, why have they got this on this spaceship? I mean, what point is it being here? It just didn't seem to have thought it through as part of the whole story. It was just a nice little trick for the game, I think.
You see, because I've not finished it, I thought it was all going to turn out to be a dream or something. That's why I had all these mind-bending, four-dimensional puzzles and weird things going on. So if you're saying that it's not, then that kind of, it kind of breaks it a bit, because why on earth would you have a ship where you can just drop through holes all the time? And it doesn't make any sense, really.
I tell you what, by the time you get to the end, it might as well have been a dream, because I just didn't understand how it ended at all.
Yeah, and it did warn us as well that there will be another. You seem to meet up with a lot of other Indians on the ship, was it, who need your help, because they live on the ship as well and have been there for eons or something, which, again, made no sense at all.
Again, it sounds to me like a typical game that's been in development for 10 years. You know, all these different ideas and tweaks and changes and things thrown at it. It's like Cameo. Oh, okay. Well, anyway, still a consensus on a thumbs up, I think, for Prey. So, yeah, check it out if you haven't tried it already. Okay, so we're going to move on now to what we call the replay debate. This is a new thing which was suggested by Foible. So thanks to him. It's just really just a quick chat about something other than the game of the month. What we're going to be discussing this month is comparing launch titles with their later sequels. And we decided before the podcast that the one we would choose is actually Burnout. Now, you probably recall that Burnout Revenge came out very early in the Xbox 360's life. And then, of course, we've then had Burnout Paradise, which has really completely changed the racing genre, in terms of scope and downloadable content. So let's start with Striden. So, may have been a while since you played both of them, but how do you feel that the Burnout franchise has developed on in this generation?
Well, I mean, I should say, to start off with, I should say that I don't really do racing games, but sorry, I'm choking there. Yeah, let me just have a bit of water.
Someone from EA, we've done it to you.
That's it. No, I mean, I should say that I don't normally play racing games, but Burnout Paradise is one that I have absolutely played to death, both on the 360 and then on the PS3. I did play Burnout Revenge, and to me, Burnout Revenge is a game that could have been done on the previous generation. And Burnout Paradise is a game that couldn't have been done for various reasons, not least the very robust online integration of a multiplayer.
I think the kind of huge open world with lots of different things to do and leaving up to you as to what you do next is very much a hallmark of this generation. It kind of pioneered in the last one with things like GTA, but you get the feeling, don't you, that those games that really stand out as being iconic for this generation are the ones that do have these huge open worlds or even open narratives. I think of things like, not just Burnout, things like Oblivion and Fallout as well, which kind of fall into the same camp.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely true. I think in some ways it seems a bit of an easier a sort of way to develop a game, in that you rely on the player making up a lot of choices of what they're going to do, and if something's broken late on in the development cycle, it's not you can pull it out or put something back in without having to worry too much.
Yeah, I think Burnout Revenge, it was on the original Xbox and PS2, wasn't it? And then they sort of brought it to the 360 and added a couple of modes. But I think it was a quick cash-in, basically, for EA, or Criterion, I think it is, isn't it? And some of the features they did add, though, did use a little bit of Xbox Live and was quite clever. So if you got taken down by someone, they would then become your revenge partner sort of thing. So you'd, even if you logged off and went back on, I believe it would still say, this person, smashed you up, basically, in this race. You need to get revenge on them. And it was that starting of an idea, which, we're now working together. Everything's online. I thought it was like the beginning of Paradise.
Yeah, I've actually played Burnout Revenge quite recently, and there are lots of elements in it. When you see it, you think, oh, yeah, you can see this was a seed of an idea that they've then taken one step further in Burnout Paradise. I mean, even on Burnout Revenge, some of the a lot of the races take place in the same parts of that city, and they reuse lots of areas of the lots of the tracks are basically similar routes with slightly slight deviations in it. And also some of the online modes, like you said, they introduce a party system. So there's the brilliant crash mode, which they sadly dropped in Paradise. You can actually party up in that, and you can play as a party against another party. So they introduced quite a few concepts like that.
Yeah, that's something I did miss, actually, from Paradise. So I started playing Burnout with Burnout 2. I never did actually play the original, but they were more just standard games, weren't they? You'd have a certain amount of, say, speed runs to do, or time lapse, or crash modes, and all this. And your progression felt a bit more natural, more like a normal game. And I missed that from Burnout Paradise. It's Paradise, it was just go to these traffic lights, rev up, and away you go. But it never felt like you were progressing as much as the old ones used to be.
The old ones were a lot more linear. I think I've got the original Burnout. That's before EA bought Criterion, and that just had like standard races and crash mode. Those were the only two things it had, really. One of the other differences really between Revenge and Paradise City is that Revenge is much, much harder. I mean, some of the races, even quite early on in that, are really difficult. Whereas on Paradise City, you always have the option of getting that better car and going back and doing it later. I think Paradise City is more of a more accessible game for everyone.
Yeah, you just reminded me of doing, like, I think it might have been Burnout 2, but it was the Formula One car, yeah, where you had to just basically do a perfect lap, a perfect series it was, and for about 10 minutes, not blink, and trying, just to get the level complete. But I really liked that about it, and that's one of the best things about Burnout, I thought, just the sense of speed and just the madness which is going on around you.
Yeah, and to be fair, yeah, they both definitely have that. So, Stride, I mean, of the two, which would you go back to now if you were going to play one?
It's Burnout Paradise, simply because I do keep going back to it. The problem I had with games like Revenge is there was always like a race that I got stuck on, and I just couldn't get past it because I'm just not that good at them. I do like going around crashing, and I do miss the crash mode of Revenge, but there was always, I'd enjoy like my first 2 or 3 hours with the game, and then I'd hit a race I just couldn't get past, and that was it. That was game over. Whereas Burnout Paradise, there's just so many other things that I've gone on and done. I've got, I do like it a lot.
I don't know if you guys have seen the video for the new Cops and Robbers mode for Paradise City, but that looks really cool, actually. Looks like a lot of fun.
If they make that like Midtown Madness 3, I'll be very happy.
Either you guys seen the video at all?
I haven't seen it yet, no.
All right, it's worth checking out.
No, I think I missed out seeing it.
Yeah, if you go to the Criterion website, it's on the front page at the moment. It's well worth looking at. It's very similar to the Midtown Madness thing, and it's... It does look good. I think they're going to charge for it. I think we're starting to see them to use the parlance, monetize the game a bit more. And they're going to start charging for these extra modes. I wouldn't be surprised if we see a crash mode either. I've got a sneaky suspicion that, they will stick in a crash mode and we'll have to pay for it.
Nah, I think that's very unlikely. I think that'll be the draw of a sequel. Because, I mean, how else are they going to sell that sequel to you? They're going to give the players one thing that they've moaned that wasn't in this game. And it's going to be in there.
Yeah, they always tried to sugarcoat the crash mode, didn't they? Saying basically, well, you could do it anywhere, and your score is put online, and you see how much damage you've made against all your friends. But I don't think it made a big enough thing about it. I just loved the whole when it used to pan out and it'd say you've caught £2 million worth of damage, and it was just awesome. You had the multipliers and all sorts, and you could bounce the car.
Well, the thing is, the crash mode in the previous Burnout games was basically a puzzle. It wasn't really a driving game as such, whereas the kind of... it's not even called crash mode, is it, in Paradise? It's called something else.
Showtime, I think.
Showtime,
isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, really, it's like a mini-game. It's not really a puzzle, because, like you said, you can do it on any road, and it's just a case of just keeping your multiplier going. They kind of lost the essence of what crash mode really was. You had to work out which vehicle you had to hit and from which angle... to get the biggest score, so it was, which just isn't the same. I don't know. I can I don't see them doing a sequel to Paradise City, actually, on this generation. I can just see them constantly adding more and more to it. That seems to be the way they're going. They're also, I don't know if you've heard the rumour, but Criterion are actually working on the next Need for Speed game, so it may not be a... they may put their magic touch on a different franchise, but we'll have to see.
Well, you just throw me on the Need for Speed one. If Criterion grab that, I'll be very happy. Yeah, I've hated the Need for Speed series since they changed it.
It's just the rumour, yeah, that the current... Because they've given the next Need for Speed to a completely different studio as well. And the one after that, it's rumoured that Criterion are working on it. Criterion have confirmed they're working on another game for another franchise, but they haven't said which one. So, yeah, it would be, wouldn't it? Because Criterion certainly know how to make a good racing game. So, okay. Next month we'll probably pick another Versus game, another game to look at its earlier version and its later iteration. So it's time to finish up, really, and talk about our nominations for next month. Just to remind everyone that the runner-up from last month's poll was Call of Duty 2, and so that will automatically be in the poll for this month, so for people to decide what is the game of the month, and the game we'll discuss on the next podcast. Strident, should we start with your nomination? So tell us what your game, the game that you're going to nominate is, and also your reasons for that.
Well, I've gone for Marvel Ultimate Alliance. One of the reasons I picked it was I thought it might be quite nice to have a multi-format launch title, so that as many people can experience it as possible. I mean, in the case of Marvel Ultimate Alliance, you can play it on the 360, on the PS3, on the Wii, which is where I played it first, actually, and also on the PC, the PSP. I think there's a PS2 version, an original Xbox version, and the usual side-scrolling Game Boy Advance version. So I thought it'd be quite nice, you know, there'd be no... people saying that they couldn't have access to the replay game. Marvel Ultimate Alliance, for those who don't know, is basically an action role-playing game, which is sort of code for saying it's a button basher, where you can select and mess about a bit with your powers, I think. You control a team of four superheroes. You can switch your control between them at any time, and you can have friends controlling the other members of the team if you like. It's sort of a iteration of the old X-Men Legends titles, but a lot less cartoony and much improved AI and stuff like that.
I think it's got it reviewed really well as well. I think it's got a pretty high Metacritic score, I think, so it's a good quality title to pick.
Yeah, and I also thought with the sequel due out this year, it might be a chance for people to have a look at the first game and see whether the sequel's something they want to take a look at as well.
Oh, that's a good suggestion. Ditz, what's yours?
I've gone for Test Drive Unlimited. This is it's one of my favourite car games of this generation so far. It's sort of like a back to basics, I don't know, sort of driving game, which kind of say that. It's more like the old Need for Speeds, I think we just said that. But you've got your Ferraris, Lamborghinis, and it's just about the driving. It's about getting to point to point, making money, getting the next car, buying new bits for your car, and just, it's all very nice and realistic, and it all takes place, I believe it's on Hawaii, and they've actually remodeled the whole island for it as well. And yeah, you can drive everywhere. You've got like a really nice GPS system, and the online as well is very much sort of an early type of Burnout Paradise, where everybody is pretty much on the same island, but you don't see everyone until you get within a certain distance. And when you do, you can flash your lights and say, "Right, let's go for a race." It's got cars, it's got bikes, all licensed things. It's a really, really good little driving game.
I've just realised why you like it so much.
Why is that?
It's an MMO.
Oh no!
It's a driving MMO.
Yeah, you level up, you gain XP. Yeah.
You can have PvP.
Yeah, yeah, it's all good. Yeah, then you can level up your cars.
There's clans because there's clubs or guilds. Yep. Yeah, I get it now. Right,
there okay. We go.
Now I think that's on. Is that on PS3 as well? I think it is, isn't it?
I think it did. I think it may have been called something different, or they got an extra version. I think it's on the PC as well, and it came on to the PS2 as well. Yeah, I believe so.
Okay. Oh yeah, I remember there was a PS2 version. Okay, my nomination is Oblivion Knights of the Nine. So not Oblivion itself, because there's no way that anyone would be able to play that all the way through to completion in a month. But it was suggested by Austinbor, actually. I did a kind of mini poll of some of my friends and discovered that a lot of people have bought Knights of the Nine, which was a DLC pack, but never actually played it. I thought it would be a nice little... I think it takes about 2 or 3 hours to complete, so it's probably a nice length. Also, if you buy the Knights of the Nine DLC, it actually includes a lot of the other DLC for free, including the infamous horse armour. It's maybe worth doing it just for that. And I think recently, certainly on the 360, the Knights of the Nine was reduced in price. So you can get Oblivion Knights of the Nine for both the Xbox 360 and the PC.
I think the PS3 version of that, because it was the Game of the Year edition, I believe came with Knights of the Nine, so...
Yeah, I thought it did. I was trying to actually, before we started recording, I was trying to search to try and find out whether it did or not. I think it does. So, again, if you've got the PS3 version of Oblivion, it will be the quest that starts at the... I did read it earlier, actually. I believe it starts at a stables or a blacksmith's or something, and it involves, as it sounds, a load of knights. So, that's my nomination anyway. Okay, so we'll stick those nominations up on the forum. We'll leave the vote open for about 7 days. And then after that, then people can start picking them up. By the way, guys, any idea on the sort of price we're looking at for those games that you've picked?
I was actually surprised how high the Marvel Ultimate Alliance was going for. I think I didn't see any really cheap prices like Prey. So it might be a case of trying to get it on rental or something like that. I think the PS3 was the cheapest version I saw. But I'm sure like the guys at Frugal Gaming will try and get us some decent prices on whatever we pick as our replay game.
I think Test Drive should be around the £5 to £10 mark. I think I've seen it in Blockbusters in the 5 for £25. So if you want to grab quite a lot of old games, that's quite a nice one to pick up with it.
Okay, yeah, I think I've seen... Certainly the original Oblivion is quite cheap because they brought out the... like you said, the Game of the Year edition, didn't they? Which included all the... I've just looked on play.com, actually. $9.99 for Oblivion, brand new.
That's not bad.
No. So, again, you can pick it up pretty cheap. The DLC, I think, was 800 points. I believe it's now 600. I might be wrong. It may have been a limited reduction. But obviously, if you get the Game of the Year edition, you get it included anyway. Okay. So that just leaves us to close up. So, as I said, the poll will be added to the forum. And you can find the forum at www.crankygamersuk.com/forum. The poll will be open for 7 days. So do check back after 7 days to see what the game is. Good places to find old games are obviously eBay, play.com, either brand new or trade, amazon.co.uk, again used or trade, Love Film for rentals, and obviously you can also use the tips from Frugal Gaming. Depending on the game we pick, obviously Test Drive Unlimited, Marvel Alliance do lend themselves to game parties, as does Call of Duty 2. Obviously if it's Oblivion, then there won't really be a game party because there's no online. Once you've played the game, or if you've played the game previously and you just want a refresher, do that. And then leave us comments, please, on the forum or email them to feedback@crankygamersuk.com. And if you use the subject replay, that should ensure that they get to myself or Ditz. If you'd like to be a guest on the show, then again, same email address, feedback@crankygamersuk.com. Or you can send a tweet to myself or Ditz via Twitter. Just to remind you that you don't have to have Skype and a fancy headset. You can actually be on the podcast with just a landline, a UK landline, because I can actually start the call and call you on the phone, as we have done in some other shows. If you have any suggestions for games to feature in future editions, for people to nominate, particularly Ditz and myself, we're probably going to go with people's suggestions if they sound good. Then again, you can use the forum at www.crankygamersuk.com, or again via Twitter. If you can, please use the tag #CGUKReplay, and then we should be able to find them. And that just leads me to do the plugs and shout-outs. So let's start with yourself, Ditz. Plugs and shout-outs from you.
Just big thank you again for having us on here. Shout out for the site as usual. I've got to say thank you to Shoinen again for having us on the Big Red Potion last week. That was good fun. Had me talking about MMOs for quite a while. And he did actually star on our Chartcast, which we recorded last night. And I'm trying to edit it down because we were talking for about 3 hours. So brace yourselves when you get this. But yeah, that's about it, really.
Awesome. Strident.
Oh, I think I'll probably just say ditto to all of those things that Ditz has said, because I mean they were on my list of people to shout out. I would just like to say it's been really nice reading the Twitters during this replay month, and you know, just following where people were in the game and how they were getting on with it. It's a nice experience playing an older game. It's something you get quite often with new games, but it's nice to get that sort of community response to an older game as well.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and there was quite a few tweets from various people saying how much they'd enjoyed it, and some people who were having to grind their way through, which is something I've got to do. Yes, that was really cool, actually. And that's really the idea of the show, is for people to be involved, and don't be nervous. Do come and join us on the podcast. Like I said, all you need is a landline or a headset.
Sorry, I've just got to give a shout out to the girlfriend. She actually bought Prey and actually completed it as well. So well done, Dom.
Blimey, yeah, actually, I was thinking of making my wife play through it because she loves first person shooters. So I was thinking of making her do it, and then I was just going to use her notes or something. Maybe I'll do that if it's Call of Duty 2, because I really don't like that game. And I've already completed it as well. Okay, and for myself, I just want to thank Foible, who was on the last show and has done a few. Quite a lot of podcasts recently. He's done a few with me, a few with the old Tosmeister, and he seems to crop up everywhere. But he's also now writing a really good beer blog, and those of you that know me will know that beer is a passion of mine. I am a member of Camera and I'm secretary of my local branch, so do have a look at that. It's at beerchimp.blogspot.com. do have a look, and thanks Foible for the suggestion on the replay debate as well. It's a good idea, mate. And that's probably it. So yeah, it's farewell from me, Zan.
It's bye from me, Strident.
And it's bye from me, Ditz.
Thanks very much, and hope you join us next month. Music. We play house music. Synthetic. Music. We play house music. Electronic. We'll be right back.
Adventure.